across the UK.
This is BBC Five Live with Stephen Nolan.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's Tuesday the 7th now of April. And did we ever think that we would be in the situation we are currently in this country? Many of us being told not to leave our homes. Many of us being told that we will know of loved ones who will end up fighting for their lives in intensive care. And the very man who stood up just weeks ago and gave us that very somber message that we would be losing some of our loved ones in this country is now himself in an intensive care unit in London. We learned tonight at 7 o'clock that the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been moved into an ICU. Let's speak to Dr. Al, who is an NE consultant from Manchester, who has been joining me on a very regular basis on Five Live. Good evening to you, Dr. Al.
Evening, Stephen.
You've just finished a hospital shift, Dr.
Yeah.
Al.
Yeah,
and you're now learning that our Prime Minister is in intensive care.
Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible news. The news filtered through in the hospital as well when I was at work. Somebody told me that the Prime Minister was in intensive care. It's wishes to him. We hope that he gets well soon and gets back to work.
So can I borrow some of your experience to get an insight into why you feel, without knowing his specific medical situation, What will Boris Johnson have around him in intensive care? Why will it have been necessary to have moved him in there?
Basically, any 55-year-old male patient
will have COVID-19. Now, we need to get that line fixed. So we throw you back behind the scenes here because I want to hear what you've got to say. It's invaluable to do so. And we'll see if we can get that fixed and we'll come back to you in a moment or two. It gives us an opportunity to speak to Dave Wooding this evening, the political editor of The Sun on Sunday. Good evening to you, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning.
Yeah, just morning. I was just looking at the clock.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, good morning.
So it's been a long evening.
Yeah, no need to guess then. What's going to be front pages of all of our newspapers?
Yes, it's on the front page of every newspaper. It has to be, of course. I think we were talking yesterday, about 24 hours ago, and I was saying that I feared this was quite serious if you've been admitted to hospital on a Sunday night. And I'm afraid my worst fears have become a reality. It's clearly more serious than any of us thought it was. Obviously, hopes he'll make a recovery, but we're all worried about him now. Everybody I've spoken to is quite worried about him.
And what type of headlines are the newspapers going with?
The ones I've seen, a lot of them are going for Boris in intensive care. It's as simple as that. I think one or two, I think the Mirror and the Daily Star have gone for Boris faces fight for life or something like that, which you could say might be a little bit too much. But nevertheless, he is in intensive care, so it is serious.
And the Sun newspaper, they're saying that doctors have prepared a ventilator, but of course in intensive care, there will always be a ventilator if needed.
Yes. So what we were told when he was taken into hospital on Sunday evening was that he was taken into hospital as a precaution. We've been told tonight that he's been taken into intensive care as a precaution. Now, he has had oxygen, but ventilators are available in intensive care. And what I'm told happens is there's various doses of oxygen. So they can give you a little whiff of oxygen to help you if you've not got enough oxygen into your blood supply. That can be stepped up into different doses, 20, 40, 60%. And then you get into the stage where you have invasive ventilation, where you have to be sedated. So you're effectively put into an M4, into a forced coma at that stage. Now, we haven't reached that stage, but he has had oxygen. And the fact that they've moved him into intensive care is a worrying development without any shadow of a doubt.
Well, David, you'll understand why I want to talk to Dr. Al now, who we've got back on the line, because he is an NE consultant. So
he'll know more than me on that.
Exactly. Let's talk about the medical situation with him. Dr. Al, good evening again.
Yeah, evening, Stephen. Can you hear me?
Good evening.
Right?
I can hear you clear as a bell now, Dr. Al. So help me understand then what you believe will have been the need to move our Prime Minister to an ICU?
So basically, from my understanding, I mean, with regards to his personal situation, we're speculating because we don't know the specifics. But if I had a 55-year-old male patient with COVID, the first step would be to put them on oxygen and make sure that their oxygenation of the body is up to 92 to 94%.
And that's before you go into intensive care, is it?
Before you go into intensive care.
Okay, now, so that's where he was up until tea time tonight.
Up to tea time tonight. And what happens is in certain patients, what we're seeing is that it dips, it comes back, it dips again, and we're unsure whether they'll be able to maintain this level of oxygen. So the very first step for those patients is, particularly with this COVID situation, that we use a medical term, proning, in which we ask the patient to lie on their tummy instead of lying on their back. And that seems to improve their oxygen levels. But if somebody is lying on their tummy and that's not helping and the levels are still up and down or dipping, then coming back, then we take a precautionary measure to put them to in an intensive care facility where we will continue to observe their oxygen levels. And if the oxygen levels drop below 88%, we can put a big mask on their face and try and give oxygen with pressure. This is something we call as continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP. Now, if that doesn't work, then the next step is to put the patient on ventilator. I think in the Prime Minister's case, I'm hoping that it's more precautionary than probably it'll be in my case or your case, and they have taken him to ICU a bit earlier than they would have with another patient. And hopefully, if they just use the proning method and he's being oxygenated, he should do fine, and hopefully in the next 24 hours we'll hear a very good news from St. Thomas.
I think we need to be careful and cautious, Dr. Allen. You are being, but I was talking to one of your colleagues earlier who was suggesting that no citizen would be moved into intensive care unless it was a critical situation. Do you disagree with that?
No, I completely agree with them. The problem with COVID pneumonia is that once the saturation of the oxygen starts dipping down, if we do not act very, very quickly and move them to intensive care, which is a precaution in most of our patients, if we delay it a little bit and the oxygen saturations actually start dipping quickly, then there is not much time on hand to provide the intensive care. So you've kind of missed the boat. So Prime Minister is not the only one. A vast majority of my patients have been moved to intensive care, even today, where we were unsure if they'll be fit for ward care. So we decided on the side of caution and moved them to intensive care instead. That's the situation.
I think, Dr. L, what is confusing for some of us is that when we heard during the press conference this evening, which was at 5 o'clock tonight, that the Prime Minister was in good spirits and was in a general ward. And then by 7 o'clock, he was in intensive care. What can happen within 2 hours to someone who is in hospital and is connected to monitoring machines with this disease?
Basically, with this disease, one of the things that we are finding out now is that it's not the virus itself which is causing the major issue. The virus is causing a pneumonia. But the situation gets worsened by the body's immune response to virus. It's something we in medical terms call as a cytokine storm. So when the body starts to fight the virus, there's a lot more inflammation as opposed to a usual disease. And the lungs struggle to deal with that kind of inflammation, and the patients start dipping very, very quickly. So I have seen multiple such patients where the saturations go down to 84, 83, then come back up to 91, and it's like a seesaw situation for a good 15, 20 minutes. And eventually we decide that we're taking them to intensive care just in case if this continues to happen and they need more help. Quite a few of them do not need any further intensive care. They stay in the intensive care unit for 10, 12 hours, start improving, and they're moved out to the general ward. And I'm really hoping that's what happens to the Prime Minister as well.
So we know that the Prime Minister moved into intensive care at around about 7 o'clock this evening.
Yes.
Are the next 24 hours telling as to his state of health?
So if we look at the normal progression of this disease, I think today is Prime Minister's 10th day of illness. So day 10 and day 11 are extremely important. By 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, either the Prime Minister would have started making some recovery, and they'll probably move him out of intensive care, or it would have gone to a situation where he's either on the breathing machine called CPAP, or they're making plans to ventilate him.
And can I talk through both of those scenarios with you, Dr. Al? So if, and please God, that he is moved back out of intensive care, that will be because his oxygen levels have stabilised. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, hopefully.
And once they stabilise, do they normally stay stabilised?
Yeah, then basically it basically, in simple words, is that the body immune system has won against the virus and the situation will start to improve from there onwards. He will have pulse and lethargy for 2-3 weeks, but there wouldn't be anything life-threatening, so he should be okay.
So the next 24 hours, less than 24 hours, in your view, will be very telling.
Yeah, very telling in Prime Minister's case, and hopefully we'll get a positive news.
And what type of tests will they be doing on Mr. Johnson, as well as the oxygen levels?
So there are a lot of blood tests, and I mean, the chest X-ray will be repeated tomorrow, I'm assuming. They would have done one today. And once again, it's speculation. I'm just talking from if it was one of my patients, that's what I would do. So they would have done a chest X-ray today. They'll do one tomorrow to see if the disease is progressing or not. There are certain blood markers such as serum ferritin levels and the lymphocyte count. They're medical terms, they're blood tests basically. And they give you a very good idea of which way the disease is going and if it's progressing further or not. If those levels start normalizing, the chest X-ray might take some time to start looking better. But the more important thing is that if the Prime Minister is either on just simple oxygen mask or not on oxygen, and he's maintaining his oxygen sats above 92%, then we have very good news in his case.
And I wanted to start with the cup half full scenario, that his oxygen levels stabilise and he's moved out of intensive care tomorrow at some stage. Dr. Al, if he is not, what will that tell us? If we hear news tomorrow night that they have decided that the Prime Minister needs to stay in intensive care, what is that likely to suggest?
So if they've decided that the Prime Minister needs to stay in intensive care, but does not need either a continuous pressure airway machine or a ventilator, that's still good news. That essentially means that just by proning him and using simple maneuvers and a lot of oxygen, he's still a manageable patient. And if we can do that for 24 hours, that's always a good news. If we hear the news that the Prime Minister was put on the big face mask machine, and that did not work, and they proceeded to ventilating the Prime Minister, that's bad news. Obviously, then that means that the Prime Minister is on the ventilator. If that was to happen, then statistically, Prime Minister has a 53% chance of survival.
Even at his relatively young age of 55?
Yes, so, I mean, the age factor is important. But what you also have to understand is that we're talking about a disease which has progressed to a level that the Prime Minister needed ventilation. So if he needs a ventilator, then statistically the Prime Minister has a 53% chance of survival in that case.
And that ventilator, and to stress, we are not at that point, and we're looking at a window in the next 24 hours where he may never need a ventilator. Hopefully not is right. But if he does, that ventilator is a tube which is put inside him, down into his lung, and is breathing for him, correct?
Yes.
And
they will completely sedate him. So it's more like having a general anesthetic before a major surgery. So you're completely sedated. You're out of it. And then we insert a tube in your windpipe to your lungs, and the machine breathes on your behalf then.
And if the machine is breathing on your behalf,
yeah,
why is there only a 53% survival rate? Because why is that not buying your body time to recover from the virus?
So basically, what you have to look at it as, like, the machine is like a pump. So if you have got a very good tire in your car, you can inflate the tire and it'll work. But if the tire is pretty badly damaged, then no matter how good of an inflator or pump you have, it's not really going to make your tire work. So I'm just giving an example just to make it understand. In a similar way, if the damage to the lung has gone through a certain, beyond a certain level, there is a good chance that that will have an impact. So there's a 19% chance of that having an impact on your heart and a 30% chance of having an impact on your kidneys. So when other organs start getting involved in the whole process and they start getting damaged, then there is only a certain amount of ventilator and the medicines can do. I'm pretty sure that the Prime Minister is in the best possible hands, and they will do absolutely everything. But what you have to understand is, Stephen, that in NHS, we would like to think that all our patients are in very good hands and we do the best for every single one of them.
Yeah.
The figure of 53% survival that I'm quoting, which is CPAP plus the ventilator, that's a global figure all over the world, in the Western countries, in the United States, in China. I'm not including the third world countries. So it's probably the best any medical team can achieve.
It's a very invasive procedure, isn't it, using a ventilator?
Is.
And I was reading earlier today, Dr. Allen, look, you're the expert, I'm not. But from my reading earlier today, another danger of using a ventilator is by the very crude fact that you're putting a tube down someone's throat inside their body. The body is then prone to infection. Is that correct?
It's yeah, so you get a certain pneumonia, ventilator-associated pneumonia. That happens to some patients, not all of them. It's caused by an organism called Klebsiella, and that is manageable to a certain degree with very strong antibiotics. The major concern with regards to COVID is that we can only support and treat the symptoms even with the ventilator. There is no cure that we can give while the ventilator keeps the patient alive. So there is no antidote to what the virus is doing to the body. It is going to be very much a wait-and-see situation for all the doctors. We will hopefully rely on the Prime Minister's fitness and his younger age and hope for him to get better. But I would be terribly worried if I heard the news that he was on a ventilator. I'm really, really hoping that it doesn't come to that and he gets better before that.
I think what's shocking is, Dr. Al, is we saw him just a few days ago standing on the steps of number 10. Now, he didn't look well, but he was standing up clapping the NHS. It's just confusing for us to think that one of the most powerful men in the world who was standing clapping the NHS a number of days later is being cared for in an ICU unit by the NHS.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, I mean, what I know from my understanding is that in New York, they have now made a definitive protocol that any patient who is going on the ventilator will first be given a cordless phone to speak to their family before the ventilator is. So these are different patients. They don't look that unwell before they're being ventilated. But once the cascade of the illness starts, if you don't ventilate them, they only get 2 to 3 hours to survive. So they can deteriorate very quickly from looking very well to very, very unwell. And it happens within a matter of hours in our hospitals. So are you
telling me that someone can be at the point where they are able to converse and are conscious and are talking to within a few hours dying. Is that what you're telling
me? Yes, I've had three or four such patients who have had a good 15, 20-minute conversations with their family. And within 3 to 4 hours, they were gone. They died. So this is the nature of the illness. People are deteriorating very quickly. We normally think it's a matter of 4 hours once they start deteriorating. But while they're in the hospital, when we are making a decision whether to ventilate them or not, we can see on the monitors that their oxygen levels are very low. But looking at them, they're talking back to us. They don't feel as unwell as you would expect them to.
And so can I take this beyond, Dr. Al, the Prime Minister? Because it would be wrong for us to speculate any further about the Prime Minister. And we will wait and pray and hope that our Prime Minister recovers. So to talk at a more general point now, I'm interested into what you began talking about there a matter of moments ago. So you are dealing with some patients and they're talking and you're able to see from their oxygen level that they might be in trouble in a few hours' time, and you're telling them to phone their relatives because that might be the last time they will talk to them. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's the nature of the illness. So there can be two different scenarios. There is one scenario where I went to the patient and explained to them what their illness was and explained to them that my personal clinical judgment was that a ventilator won't increase their survival chances. And if they agreed not to have a ventilator, I've given them a phone to speak to their families, and I've spoken to the families myself, and I've told them what the situation is. And those patients didn't survive, but they got the chance to speak to their families over the phone beforehand. Some people who we are about to ventilate, we do put all the scientific figures in front of them. So if we haven't had the chance to do the continuous positive airway pressure thing, and we're going straight for a ventilator because we think we don't have the time to do that, then the survival chances are only 14%. So we know that it's a tricky situation. We put it in front of the patient that, look, we're going to start ventilating you, but your chances of survival are only 14%. So before we do that, do you need 5 minutes to speak to your family or a loved one over the phone? Because we don't say that you might not get this chance again, but basically that's what we're implying.
My goodness, Dr. Al, what a conversation to have with someone. And you're having to do that at speed.
Yeah, it's becoming increasingly difficult for all the doctors involved. But we are in the past trained to have such conversations. I think the thing that we're really struggling with or coming to terms with is that we are better at face-to-face conversation with relatives of whose loved one is a patient. Doing that over the phone is causing us a bit of a disquest. It's causing us, there's a lot of pressure on us. There's a lot of tension. People are struggling with that.
What do you say to people on the phone?
Well, we start by apologizing and telling them that if it's a situation where we think the ventilator is not going to work, we inform them that your loved one is likely to have a COVID infection. They're deteriorating fairly quickly. We don't think that they're going to survive for long. And we apologize that as their doctor or as their nurse, we can't really offer any more treatment to make them any better. And more often than not, the families would then like to come and see their loved ones. And you have to also inform them that that's not a very good idea with the infection in the hospital being that high. But it's entirely up to them if they want to pay a visit.
So they have a choice to come to the hospital?
So one member of the family in most of the hospital is allowed to come in and see them. Some hospitals don't even allow one relative.
And then if we come back to the patient has had a conversation with someone like you, and you have said to them, look, we need to put you on a ventilator. Would you like to have a conversation with your family? Because there is a statistically there is a 53% chance that you will survive this, and therefore a 47% chance that you will not. And those people have a conversation with their family.
Yeah.
And that all has to happen within what? A couple of hours? Or is it minutes?
No. So the conversation, if we are preparing for it, ITU move and an intubation and ventilation, and that's what the plan is, then the conversation has to be fairly limited. You get 4 or 5 minutes because you have to crack on and try and give them the best possible chance of survival. If there is a patient who's not for ventilation, then they can take their time because obviously there's nothing much invasively that we can offer to make them any better.
But you're telling me, sorry, Dr. Al, that for those people who will need a ventilator, because we're hearing about governments scrambling to try to get as many ventilators as possible, and what we're not hearing is the wider story around the use of ventilators. So for those of us who will need a ventilator, you're telling me that within a matter of minutes, we're being told, make a decision as to whether you want it, and phone your family and have a couple of minutes of a conversation, and you've got a 50-50 chance whether you're going to have another conversation with them again. And that's all happening within minutes, is it?
Yes, but what we are trying to tell them is that you can put it like a 50-50 chance, but you can also put it in a way that this is your only chance. If we don't do this right now, then you don't really stand a chance against this illness.
I understand that.
And as a doctor, I want to give you the best possible chance that I can. Stephen, I don't want to sound like someone who's very pessimistic, because I normally am not, but I have to tell you, for most of the healthcare providers, I mean, I personally have seen one of my colleagues today who works on one of the wards as a nurse, and we ended up ventilating her, and that wasn't a very easy thing to do. It is by far the most taxing clinical situation I've ever been in the 17 years of my clinical life.
Why?
And because most of the... So I have got an incredibly supportive partner that I live with. Every time I walk out of the house to go to work, I don't know if it's the last time I'm leaving house, whether I'm going to see her again or not, because if I start developing symptoms while I'm at work, I'll have to self-isolate elsewhere. And if I deteriorate and need a ventilator, they won't let her come and see me. So every day I go to work might be the last time I've seen her. Starting from there, going to work, talking to people's families over the phone, telling them that their loved ones are dying, and basically dying alone, to going in the back of the ambulances to see if we need to continue resuscitating people and verifying and confirming them to be dead behind in an ambulance truck, to all the issues around the personal protective equipment. And there are certain illnesses that we are so good, certain emergencies that we're so good at treating. But when you mix them with COVID, it's anybody's guess which treatment is right and which treatment is wrong, at the highest level, even to the professors and everything, because we're dealing with something so new. It's like a lot of people use the term front lines for us. And we're like at front lines without any armor or without any gun against an enemy that we don't know how to defeat. So that's why from my very first phone call that I made you, I've been saying again and again that we have to pay respect to this virus, to this enemy. We have to social distance and self-isolate ourselves. Other than that, there is absolutely no way going forward that we can overcome this.
I think that the thing that always blows my mind, Dr. Al, when you come on talking to me, it is the clarity with which you talk about how brutal this disease is, together with the kindness that you clearly represent. You sound like a gentleman, and the bravery with which, you know, you're approaching your work. And I know you don't like me saying that, but the rest of us can hear it. and it is personified when you describe walking out of your front door and you don't know whether you're going to ever get to talk and see your partner again. And that gentle doctor who I've never met but I've spoken to you on a number of occasions, compared to the brutality of this disease, it just blows my mind every time.
I mean, our Prime Minister is in intensive care tonight. I mean, what else do we need to know how brutal this disease is? And I tell you something, with all these skills and knowledge and, you know, medical science and drugs and medicines and all that we have, even with our own Prime Minister, we're going to be in a wait-and-see situation. I mean, there's not much that we can do aggressively. We're hoping more than, you know, aggressively treating an illness. And the other day I found out that I found out in the news that we lost a five-year-old child. All I can say to people again and again is that despite the fact that it's next to impossible to stay indoors for such a long time, till we have an antibody test, till we have an exit game, this is the only way to deal with this particular situation. I have got colleagues who are doing far, far more than I am doing. They're staying away from their children. They're staying away from their families. They're worried for their children and their families. There are nurses and doctors staying in hotels. They're not going home for days, weeks now, so that they could come to work and they could continue to work. And people are working 12, 14, 16 hours to deal with it. The only thing that slightly worries us or gets us a bit down is the helplessness in front of this virus, where we do everything that we know we can't do and none of that works, and we can see our patients slipping away and we just stood there helpless, not being able to do something about it. In NHS, we're not very used to that. I was listening to your show before this call and some gentleman came in who had CA prostate and he was praising the NHS. And that's what we've been all about. We deal with every disease aggressively. We try and make our patients as better as we possibly can. But this virus is making us feel very helpless at the moment.
My final question to you, Dr. Al.
Yes,
please God, you get through this as well.
Yes.
Will you ever be the same again, given what you've witnessed? Is this a life-changing event for you?
It is a life. It definitely is a life-changing event. It's. I mean, I've learned the. I mean, you look at the value of life and you figure out that you know what life is all about. I think at the end of the day, at the moment, I mean, I've been fearful about this from day one. The hospital where I am has got 60 ventilators. Right now, we're using 39. By Easter weekend, if we're using all 60, I don't know what's going to happen after that. I don't want to think about that right now.
Well, you do know what's going to happen. You're going to have to start making tough choices.
We will make tough choices, but we're also very, very looking forward to this XL in Manchester, the new hospital coming in, and hoping that they will have a lot of ventilators. I don't know where they're coming from, but I'm just hoping that there is going to be ventilators available. But if there's none available and we have to make even tougher choices than what we are making right now, all these patients that I've seen so far, the ones that I couldn't help as much as I had wanted to, all my healthcare worker colleagues, everyone in NHS who looks after them, it's going to be next to impossible to forget these people for the rest of our lives. We talk about them. When somebody gets better, there's a lot of jubilation. There's a lot of happiness around. But it's not happening a lot right now. And that's something that's getting us down. So I don't think life is ever going to be the same again.
And if I was to ask you, finally, of a patient who along this journey sticks in your mind so far, that when you put your head on your pillow at night, is there someone in your mind?
Yeah, I saw a gentleman, he was only 48, and he was looking after an elderly lady who had ankle fractures. He was just a carer, and because she had ankle fractures, he was looking after her for 10 days with PPE, without any PPE. He was just seeing her as a normal patient, and she turned out to be positive. And then this carer got positive. Just because they were providing care, and they ended up being on a ventilator. I just felt that I was, when I was dealing with him, I just felt that I was dealing with a national hero who did his job very, very, very well. It's just that there is no recognition of that on national level. But from my perspective, we, all the NHS staff that day, we saluted him for being such an amazing carer and putting his life online. It's been 5 days now. I'm still, fingers crossed, hoping that they will come off the ventilator, but they're still being ventilated.
You know, you're one of our national heroes too, Dr. Al. You know,
no,
that.
I'm not. I'm just trying to do my job. I think, Stephen, and I'm honestly saying that, if you come where I work, you would actually see people who are like far, far above and beyond me doing what they're doing. Dr. Al, amazing people.
But listen to me, sir. We've spoken to each other on a number of occasions on Five Live. I have never met you in my life before. But I can tell you now that there is no doubt as to the hero that you are and how you personify the bravery of every single member of the NHS staff, cleaners, porters, doctors, nurses, security staff that are saving lives. You've just got it, Doctor. You convey it. It oozes out of you. And I'm not being falsely complimentary to you. It is the kindness and the gentleness and the humility that you have that makes you sound very, very special. So I want to say thank you for what you do. And hopefully we will talk again.
Thank you, Stephen. And just keep spreading the message that everybody needs to stay indoors. We need to do this for a few more weeks at least.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Take care.
Well, I don't know about you, but it just blows my mind. It just does when you listen to him. If you want to react to that tonight, if you want to pick up the phone, 08085 909 693. We'll pause there and we'll get the latest news from Jill.